Dr. Benham Abu Al-Suf, welcome to the Watson Institute. In the antiquities world, you are well known and hugely respected for a life's work in archaeology and museum curating. So, well, I'm thinking we have 10,000 years that we could talk about, or that you could talk about with authority. But of course, we're maybe interested first in why you're here and what has happened to your country. Can you describe your own position as your standing in that society over the last 20, 30, 40 years as a professional archaeologist and also significantly as a Catholic in a Muslim country? How did you manage your own career?
Well, Chris, since I was a boy, I born in Mosul, in the old city of Mosul, in a Catholic family. My father was a churchgoer, and my home was in a district where a mixture Muslim and Christian. And we were living in peace and in harmony with each other, actually. Even Jewish, they were in Mosul, a big community of Jewish part of the city, before they immigrated to Palestine late in the 40s. And Chris, I grown up as an athlete, as I started bodybuilding and loving to have a strong body like those Greek heroes. And that's why I came to be an love archaeology. So,
really?
So in Mosul, I was good in swimming. I was in the Tigris, we swim usually in Mosul. And so if you are an athlete and you have a strong body, strong character, everybody respects you. And nobody will, actually nobody was trying to insult anybody, whether Christian or otherwise. This talk about Christian, Muslim, this appeared after the 14 July coup d'etat 1958. The first time I heard it in the 63, I think, in Baghdad talk that those were Christian, those were Muslim. But before that, before 62, 63, I really didn't hear such thing. And I think also the reason, Chris, because after 58, when parties were free to show
their colors, so to speak.
Pardon?
We would say to show their colors.
The color, yes. But I must admit that nobody accusing me because I was non-politically oriented. I was independent always. Usually I didn't announce everywhere that I am Christian. Even my colleagues in Baghdad in the university, two, three years, they thought I am a Muslim because I look like, I talk like, and my habit, my behavior, my personality doesn't show that I am from the minority, you see?
Yes. I wish you'd speak more, Ben, about Mosul, old Mosul. I mean, it is pictured now in part of that Sunni triangle, but it is also described as a very, very complex, tolerant, interesting city, and the home, the starting point, with Claudius Rich, I believe, of modern archaeology.
Yes, well, you see, an old city of Mosul. Mosul is a colorful city. It was golden era.
Which?
Harmony, I mean, politically, socially, it was golden era, really. Quiet, peace, and law prevailed. It was the era of law and order.
This is the 50s.
Under the royal regime. Till 58, the so-called revolution of 14 July 58 of the code, the military coup d'etat, and after that, trouble began.
Hmm. When you say royal regime, you mean the Hashemites?
The Hashemite. Started 1920, ended 1958, July 1958.
And this was installed by the British or overseen by the British?
No, the British, you see, occupied Iraq 1917-18. And 1920, they gave Iraqi semi-independent and form a local government and brought King Faisal.
Explain what you mean about a golden time under the royal regime.
Well, you see, it golden age started at the time of Faisal the First. Actually, he was very wise man, and he could dominate the country. Several sects, several nationalities, several religions with wisdom, and there were actually in the 30s and 40s and 50s parliamentary system. There were two houses of parliament, and these two houses remind us of that in the ancient Sumer in 2700 BC, Chris, Gilgamesh, the king of Warka, of Uruk, the Epic of Gilgamesh were known. Gilgamesh had also two houses of parliament, the young fighter and the elders. So parliamentary system in Iraq is very old. Even I think it is the oldest parliamentary system in the world, 2700 BC.
Interesting.
In my writing, in my talk in the radio or television, I explained such which no archaeologist, other archaeologist did it before me. I explained this. And the Epic of Gilgamesh, you know, this is a symbolic. His opponent was Enkidu. Enkidu represent the non-settled life, the wilderness life, the shepherd life. Gilgamesh representing the urban, the city life, the educated, the culture, the civilized. So Enkidu was living with animals in the wilderness. So some people, elderly people, advised Gilgamesh, send him a woman to sleep with him. She will make him civilized. And she will bring him, it's because he wanted to hunt him. And he couldn't because Enkidu was running with the wild animal. So he sent a harlot, of the temple, a priestess, a prostitute from the temple. She went by the river Euphrates. She took off her clothes. And when he came to drink with the animal, he saw the woman. Instinctively, he was drawn to her. So he slept with her. The epic says he slept with her 7 nights and 7 days. Without interruption. So after that, he realized that there is that to be with a woman is good, is nice. Why should he run with the animal? And he sat after 7 days and 7 nights, sat at the feet of the woman by the river Tigris, the Euphrates. So the woman told him, Enkidu, Enkidu, why should you live? Continue living with the animal. You should come to the city of Uruk, of Warka, where the hero Gilgamesh is a king. The temple are adorned with jewels, where the people are wearing clothes, and there are many beautiful women. You can marry 4, 5, 10. So she led him by hand to Warka, and he met Gilgamesh. And they fought, they wrestled, because Gilgamesh Abed was to take the first night from a groom of the bride, you know. When a young man married to a young woman, the first night was to Gilgamesh. So that was bad habit. The people didn't like it. So Enkidu, when Gilgamesh was entering the groom, bridegroom house, Gilgamesh put his feet in front of him and prevented him. And they fought in the square of Warka. They say, the epic says they fought as a huge bulls. And the walls of the palaces and temple were shaking. Where after that, Gilgamesh could bring him down to Enkidu, and they became friends. They became friends, and the story started, actually. Gilgamesh was a very beautiful man, hero, actually. Later on, when he conquered Enkidu, he combed his hair and has a bath and anointed his body. And he and Enkidu were walking in the street of Warka, and the people and the young maidens were clapping their hand and singing. Gilgamesh batal labtal, Gilgamesh zain al-rijal, Gilgamesh. This rhyme is beautiful. Gilgamesh, hero of the heroes. Gilgamesh, best of the men. Gilgamesh batal labtal, Gilgamesh zain al-rijal.
Interesting. Well, I want to say it is such a pleasure to hear a man for whom, you know, a year, 50 years, 100 years, 10,000 years, it's all the same.
Yeah.
It's all in your head.
You, see, you were there. As an open book, I read it. I mean, because I lived with it. Not only I studied it, but in the last 50 years, I lived those events. I don't practice archaeology as a government employee or official. I practice archaeology as a lover, more than admirer, as a lover. That is why I made good progress in archaeology. And when I used to talk on the TV or any correspondent channel, not only Iraqi but Arab and Western, I don't need to have a paper or numbers and names and events. All are written here on my chest, on my mind.
10,000 years.
10,000 years or more of events I have in my memory. I explained it to the in the television and told the people, this is not only a story of these two heroes. It was a story of how domesticated started, how shepherd became urban, went into urban life. This fight, this wrestle, that it means. Not only fight with two heroes. No, it was a fight with urban life and country life. Yeah. But when Iraq was happy and the people were have leisure time to enjoy, athletes and heroes were admired. In Mosul City, we had young admirers like Gilgamesh. When he used to walk in Warka, a beautiful girl used to shout, hero of heroes, best of men. You know, also in Mosul, I remember in the 40s or early 50s, when we walk with our body, you know, and muscles shone, although girls were shy and we could not make advances openly to girls, but they admired the athlete people, really. And in the swimming, I used to be the first, swimming 40 kilometers in the Tigris. Yeah, I took prizes and things, yeah. I saw many things in my life. Christopher Habibi, my friend. Habibi, yani my friend. look what you are. You are really make me suffer sometime because you are bring to my mind those lovely memories of the old time. I like them.
This is good. I love listening.
I like them. I tell you, when we used to like a girl and she likes us, we hide ourselves. Either we steal a look from her window or when we go to the church and we just have a look in the church. To shake hand, that was a victory.
Ben, after the revolution in the 50s, late 50s, and through the 60s and in the Ba'athist years after that, your career thrived. I mean, you did very well as an archaeologist.
Yes.
And some very important work was undertaken by the Iraqi government, and well done by all accounts.
Yes.
How did that work?
Well, you see, the country was developing and feeling pride in the ancient relics. So any government coming after the royal regime were actually forced to or liable to take care of the museum and the archaeological relics and the excavation and even actually Department of Archaeology in Baghdad University started in 1951 under the royal regime, and I was from that first session of 1951. I graduated the first session, graduated in 1955. And we were the young archaeologists beside our two elderly professors who were taking their degree in Chicago in the Oriental Institute and two other in Germany. And we, at that time, we were 10, graduated with an BA. I was one of the top and immediately went to the field at that time. And I loved the field. And I loved archaeological life in the wilderness, in the countryside, actually. That is why I think I am a modest person. I became rather good archaeologist. In 1960, they sent me on a scholarship to Cambridge, England. I did my PhD.
You were a man of the dig yourself.
I dig with my assistant, and we have gangs of labor. We call them Shergatis. They dig themselves, but we oversee, we supervise as an archaeologist. But those gang of villagers, they learn to excavate in 1903 till 14 in Ashur. Andre, the German excavator, he picked them from villages across the Tigris in the city of Ashur, from Jubur tribe city, and taught them how to excavate the mud brick, the mud building. So offspring and sons of these early worker, they inherited the occupation. And we employ them as workmen, actually.
Did you have a favorite site? Did you work in Nineveh?
Yes, I worked in Nineveh, but Nineveh was excavated by Layard and by Malawan. And my favorite excavation in the late 60s, I discovered a Neolithic village on the Tigris, north of Baghdad, 150 kilometers, called Tell Suwan, the Mound of Suwan, which gave us new information, new data on the relation of northern and southern culture of Mesopotamia, which we didn't know yet at that time. You have to make comparison. You have to go back to literature. You have to show. Well, I took the opportunity among few, actually, and I benefited and became, as they describe me, as a good archaeologist. And even in the thinking of some that I was the sheikh of the archaeologists. You know sheikh, what is sheikh?
Of course.
Sheikh of the archaeologists of the country. But I consider myself still a pupil in the field, because in every expedition you learn. I never told myself that I have reached the top. I always wanted to learn. And I learned from these elderly workmen who worked since the early years of the 20th century with foreign expedition, and they are illiterate, but they are good diggers, good excavator in the ground. I was very modest, and they taught me, because I like them and I sit with them in the trenches and eat with them, sleep with them. So they really taught me a lot. And one of my benefit, I mean, why I became good archaeologist, because I learned from the elderly workmen. So I advise young Arab archaeologist to be modest and to learn from the worker, some Iraqi perhaps, or Arab archaeologist, young, graduated with high degree. They think that they know, and they just stand up and watch. They don't go down to the trenches. And they were aloof and look down at these workmen. Mm. They don't learn. They will continue being armchair archaeologists,
yes.
But not field archaeologists.
It's exciting to hear you talk about it, and it's humbling to just to be reminded that, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years, that was the center of the human race.
My Neolithic site is 6,000 B.C., a village near Baghdad, 6,000 B.C.
Hmm.
So the area of Baghdad was not empty when the caliph, the Abbasid caliph al-Mansur, chosen the site to build Baghdad. Baghdad was inhabited. Earlier in the 5th, 4th millennium, and Baghdad area was crowded with monastery and Christian villages. When the Caliph al-Mansur, late in the 7th century, picked up the area to build the round city of Baghdad.
Mm. You make me want to go. Shall we go tomorrow? If you were taking me to one site in Iraq, just to see what can be learned and can be seen of these ancient, ancient places, where would we go?
I may take you to Nineveh, Chris, because in Nineveh, on the Acropolis, you can see the Assyrian and before.
Hmm.
I take you to Erbil, Qal'a, to the citadel of Erbil. You can see the Islamic Kurdish on top, and at the bottom you can see the Neolithic.
Ben, I'm told that Iraq relates to its antiquities much more closely, both the government and even popular culture and people, than other countries in the Arab Middle East. Is that true? I mean, differently from Egypt, perhaps, or Jordan, or Saudi Arabia.
Well, you see, all these countries have their own antiquities and have their own background, actually. Maybe Iraqi government, Iraqi authority, late in the 60s and 70s and 80s, spent more money, allotted more money in their budget to do excavation.
Hmm.
And even Saddam Hussein, although he described as a dictator, but he spent a lot of million and million of dinar on excavation and on buying antiquity from the citizen if they have antiquities.
Hmm.
I was a member of that committee, scientific and a special committee who used to pay the people who bring us antiquity.
Hmm.
So he was interested in history and in the relic, and also he doesn't want Iraqi antiquities to be smuggled outside Iraq. So instead of those people sell it outside, they come and sell it to us in the Iraqi Museum, in the Iraq Department of Antiquity.
Ben, as a rising archaeologist in that world, what was your relationship to the government, and what did you see happening in the Ba'athist regime in the 60s, 70s, 80s, into the 90s?
Chris, as an archaeologist, as a scientist, as government official, yes, I was, but I was mainly most of the year living in the wilderness, in the countryside. When I come to town, to my office, to my department, I really didn't feel intimidated by any regime because I come with air of wilderness.
Hmm.
You understand that?
Yes.
I felt free from desk work. I didn't need to be given any post to sit on the desk and the chair. I was free like a bird in the countryside to dig, so they respected me all.
There you are, an independent professional, an archaeologist with sort of the dust on your shoes. You're doing your work, but you're connected to something that's very important to the government. And a citizen.
We are colleagues, friends.
Yes.
Yes, but you see, I mean, that doesn't mean that I mean, they didn't give me any post because I was not Baathist.
Hmm.
You understand?
Yes.
Yeah. I talk. They say, well, let him talk. He's a good professor, a good archaeologist. But also I was not fit to have any post, Chris. I mean, I am a free thinker.
Mm.
I want to stay free. I mean, to have a government top post or prominent post, you have to say yes in such regime or any regime. You have to say, I wanted to stay, I like my freedom and my liberty and my living for the field. Well, some used to ask me, why don't you have a post? I told them, I am an archaeologist.
Hmm.
I am not fit. I am not useful to, because free thinker and intellectual and archaeologist living romantically will not be useful in administration. I might ruin any department or ministry. I ruin it by free way of thinking, you know. You see, this is from the royal regime up to the Baathist, up to Saddam. They respected me, really. They saw in me a real dedicated worker, like a monk, dedicated to my hobby, archaeology and excavation. I didn't need anybody. I didn't need any government.
Mm.
God gave me satisfaction, and I was not in need economically. I get my salary, okay, but my late wife was also working, and I didn't need to humble myself to any government office.
Mm.
Even Saddam used to like my talking in the television.
And what was that like? Talking to him, I mean.
Not talking to him, talking in the television. He viewed the television, of course. And he used to tell Tariq Aziz, look, your friend, he used to call me Ashurbanipal. Ashurbanipal, the famous Assyrian king, whose library found in Nineveh. And because I resembled the Assyrian, so he used to tell the people, look at the Ashurbanipal is talking. Well, that doesn't mean that I am his follower, no. But he just, I mean, Saddam, I don't think loved anybody or liked anybody.
Mm.
Only himself, perhaps, I don't know. But he enjoyed watching me.
Mm.
And he used to tell, Tariq Aziz used to tell me. He used to tell Tariq Aziz, well, this, look at this man. I really like him. He talks without fear. He's bold. I wish there are many Christians like him in Iraq.
And what did you see happening in the government, in the society, and most especially in the war with Iran? I mean, what was happening to your country all this time?
Well, you see, I mean, if you ask me, we didn't need that war. We didn't need that war. It was a mistake. Was Saddam afraid that the mullah, that the religious regime to attack Iraq? I don't know, really. But you see, historically, Chris, Mesopotamia, Iraq, and Iran were always bitter enemies. Mesopotamia or Iraq is the land, fertile land between the river. and always these across and beyond. We are hoping to have this fertile land.
Yes.
So we were bitter enemies with thee. And always kings or leaders of Mesopotamia since Sargon were always fighting the Iranian tribes and the Iranian will to come to Mesopotamia. So did Saddam inherit that will or that desire?
Mm.
Was he afraid that the mullahs of Iran or the religious rule of Iran might they come and try to occupy part of the country, and he started the war to prevent that? I didn't know. Believe me, I didn't know, Chris. But it was a disaster. We lost a lot, not only money, but young men.
Yes.
Yeah. And after it ended, we thought that now Iraq will be at rest. But then Iraq, Saddam entered Kuwait.
Yes, talk about it.
Which is even more bad, actually.
Could anybody say it at the time that this was a mistake?
Well, not openly, but we all knew it was a mistake. Hmm. We talked among ourselves with each other. It was a mistake, really. Hmm. But you cannot tell at that time the regime because you will be put to death.
Hmm.
Nobody could oppose the regime, no.
Saddam Hussein, whatever else he did, valued archaeology and the treasure of Iraq's ancient past. I wonder, what is the future of that past today?
Well, you see, it is good. This is one good thing Saddam did, actually. But he was living in history. You see, he respected history. He respected historian. I am one of them. I was one of them. He respected the ancient culture, civilization of Iraq and Arab and Muslim culture. Very much he respected. But I am afraid he tried to imagine himself one of the heroes of the history.
Yes.
You see, this is what's dangerous. To try to, you know, to act as one of the hero of the past, Arab heroes, Arab lead, Arab marshal, Arab or Babylonian leaders, Sumerian, Gilgamesh. It is dangerous because then, I mean, he was dreaming of great Iraq, of great Mesopotamia during the time of the Assyrian, of the Akkadian, and I think this, partly I would say, this made him follow his women, go to the Gulf, because the Gulf was belonging to Mesopotamia.
What was your own view, Dr. Ben, of the American intervention, the Gulf War number one, which drove Saddam out of Kuwait but didn't pursue him to Baghdad?
Well, the Gulf War number one, I think it was at that time wise of Bush the father not to come to Baghdad to overthrow Saddam, because that also will have to bring chaos to the country.
Mm.
Although Saddam was not popular, very much popular from the entire people, but to bring him down then, and this is expressed, I think, I heard it on the Voice of America in English on the summer of 91. Dick Cheney was the defense minister,
yes.
Was talking to a woman and a man journalist, and I heard him saying that we could have entered Baghdad and toppled down Saddam, but we were afraid that what will happen?
Yes.
What chaos? Because what I remember in his, whom to bring in his place. He said, I remember, Iraqi people will not be satisfied with anybody we will put in his place. Mm. And I remember saying that the Ba'asid and Saddam are keeping law and order. Why should we busy ourselves or make our army going to be police? So I think it was wise from Bush the father not to enter Baghdad and topple Saddam at that time. Although having 10, 12 years of sanction, it was very paining. It was very difficult time, Chris. Women, families were selling their properties. Women were sitting in the street selling their sewing machine, their kitchen crockery. So the U.S., instead of toppling him, enforced more cruel action, the sanction.
Mm.
Yeah. It hurt the people, but didn't hurt him, Chris. He was selling, smuggling petrol and selling and living well, building palaces.
Yes.
But the people, 20 million, more than 25 million, were suffering. Salaries were low for the office, for the civil service or the pensioner.
Hmm.
For example, one day my pension was 8,000 dinar, which is $4.
Hmm.
My monthly salary, I took it from the bank and I bought one bottle of Nescafe.
You know, you raise a very interesting point about Dick Cheney. It's never quite been explained how he changed the logic toward intervention in his own mind.
Yeah.
Not to hit Baghdad in 91, but to go in full force in 03.
You know. Yeah. Before the invasion, before 2 or 3 months, 5 months, a year, Saddam used to appear in the television, sitting at the head of a table, and around him, army officers and civilian engineer, talking about atomic thing.
Hmm.
Hmm? I really was frightened. Why he's talking like this, and the United States is accusing us we are having? I know we don't have, because my neighbor, two professor, Maslawi, working in the atomic agency where, and they said we have nothing, finished. My Tariq Aziz, my friend and colleague.
The foreign minister.
The prime minister, or acting, or anyway. So I saw him one day on Christmas. I went to say good Christmas to him. He's a Christian, you know.
Yes.
I told him, Abu Ziyad, why the president appear in the television every week and talk about the atomic thing and the weapon, and we don't have. This is dangerous. I mean, this will push America more to attack Iraq. Can't you tell? You know what he told me?
Right.
Saddam want to frighten the U.S.
Hmm.
I told him, look, America frightened from what we have of atomic weapon and we don't have. This is not a real good policy. Yeah.
Ben,
yeah.
I'm wondering, as a free thinker, what did you make of the stories you surely heard that the Americans were coming, that Ahmad Chalabi was the sort of political spear point, and that Iraq was about to become a kind of American friend or client state,
yes,
or base in the Middle East? What did you make of that plan when it was first put out in 02, in the start of 03?
Well, believe me, Chris, I don't know these people. These people were Ahmad Chalabi. For example, since 1958, he was a young man in the in the intermediate school. He went abroad. For 40 years he was abroad.
Mm. Dr. Ben, can you take us back to that moment in your own mind when the bombs struck, the shock and awe, on March 20th, 2003, at the start of the American invasion? What did you hear? What were you thinking?
Well, you see, I heard it. I was asleep. And bomb everywhere, racket everywhere. Well, I only said, my God, they did it again.
They?
I said, they did it again.
Who's they?
The American. I said, oh, my God, they did it again.
Hmm.
And I said, why, Saddam, you are to be blamed.
What was your hope for the American invasion, if the Americans took power?
Well, it was an invasion, Christopher, and I was hoping that they will straighten things up very fast. I was hoping that they will dominate the country with a strong hand, not allowing looting and killing and criminal to go around. And I was hoping that, as happened to Germany and to Japan after they lost the war, everything will be started to be rebuilt and renewed again peacefully. But it seemed that hope didn't come true.
Dr. Ben, when did you realize that the antiquities, the museums, were in danger?
Well, a friend, a colleague phoned me that the museum was looted, so I went. I took my car, and I could drive. I went to the museum. Just on the 9th or later, a day or two later, I think 3 days, and I saw what happened, and they told me, the young people who were staying in the museum, that the American army didn't do anything to prevent the looting. One young man, a young archaeologist, was staying in the building. He said, I went to the square about 200 meters. There was an officer in an armed vehicle, in a tank, and he told us that he asked that officer to come and prevent looting the museum. And the officer told him, it is not our job to be policemen.
Hmm.
But I think they could have. They prevented looting the Ministry of Oil.
Yes.
They could at least surround. Well, only one tank would be frightened any looter in the Iraq Museum. One tank standing on the gate. Finish.
And Donald Rumsfeld said, well, stuff happens. This is freedom at work. I mean, from that.
Is it the freedom to loot? Why there was no looting in Afghanistan?
Hmm. So, after it's all over, what is the damage to the world treasury of these antiquities?
Look, Christopher, I am an optimistic man. I believe no big damage happened. The main unique pieces of the Sumerian hall now were back, about four or five pieces. This is great. The rest are coming, and the rest are important, historical relics, but not as unique and as famous like those Sumerian pieces. What was lost, I don't think will really compromise a big historical loss.
Hmm. Yet people worry also that there's, in the field today,
yes.
People are stealing,
yes,
antiquities.
Yes, as there is no security. And if they dig, nobody could prevent them because nobody will reach them. But to dig, it is simple. But to smuggle, it is difficult. I mean, to dig to do what? Nobody will buy. Nobody will allow them to smuggle to Jordan or Saudi Arabia or the Jordanian. Even the Syrian, they are not allowing.
Mm. Ben, let's talk about Iraq today, today and in the future.
What happened later, after a year or a few months of unsettled, of chaos, the people started to think that this is the, I mean, at least, although they were suffering under Saddam, but at least there was security.
Hmm.
You see, it is not the mistake of the American, this chaos alone. No. My opinion, Chris, they shouldn't have dissolved the army.
Yes.
I saw some young officers, captain and selling petrol in the street.
Yes.
They know me. Doctor, could you give us, because I was on the committee of the Alawiya Club, and Alawiya Club is one of the high social club. They asked me, could we be guard in the Alawiya Club?
Hmm.
They are selling petrol for cars. They have no salary. I told them, why you are selling petrol? They said, well, how do we live with our families?
Hmm.
A city, you live in a city where there is only 1 or 2 hours a day electricity.
Hmm.
And you either buy power from neighboring thing, how do you call it?
Generator?
Generator, yes. Or you live on a candle. I had candle, hundreds of candles at home. And I built my house 30 years ago in an elegant new East Baghdad district. But around my house, surrounded with a pool like in Venice, the sewage system is not working.
Mm.
You go to the street and you don't know whether to come back to your home or not because of explosion and killer, kidnapper. Just last September, my neighbor next door, a wealthy Baghdadi Shi'i, left the home, he and his family, and went to Syria, and the home is vacant, empty.
Mm.
This man, it seemed that has many question mark on his name and with the American troops. So 2 o'clock Sunday, first Sunday on September, the American troop came, surrounded the house, and when they knock, nobody answered. They fired sound bombs, and the big sound made half of my window looking at that house broken.
Hmm.
Yes, and next morning I had to go and bring people to mend them. So you can't go to your ordinary job in the university or in the museum or what do you call this? Isn't it a hell?
Hmm.
I mean, that is why when somebody asked me when I told them I just came from hell. It is like hell. Anyway.
When do you think the intelligentsia, the professional class, intellectuals like you, will feel welcome and safe in a new Iraq? Can you imagine going back?
Yes, when law and order prevail, when security prevail, when there is a strong government.
You spoke of the royal regime into the 50s as a golden time.
Yes, yes.
Do Iraqis want the Hashemites back again?
Well, I think a fraction of Iraq, let me say 20-30%, especially the intellectual university professor. I said this in a meeting in a hall in Alawiya Club. In the fall of 2003, I announced in that meeting that I prefer that we should bring back the monarchy and the Hashemite family. I told them it was the golden age of Iraq, peace, quiet, prosperous. and no fraction, no sectarian. And the family, the Hashemite family, is a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. Everybody, every Muslim, respected. And we know their practice in Jordan successful. According to the constitution, the king will be bound by the constitution, and parties would play, and the parliament will, on the recommendation of the king, will appoint a prime minister, and will be democracy and freedom of press and everything. So, without a strong government, Grace, there will be no strong Iraq.
How is that going to happen?
Well, I always think that sovereignty, when it was given in June 2004, Bremer gave sovereignty to the temporary government headed by Prime Minister Ayad Alawi. I wished that the American administration and Bremer not insisting on having fast election on January 2005. I would have hoped that they would let Alawi, Ayad Alawi, as a tough prime minister and as a typical Iraqi, as he has connection with all sects in the country, with the old army. You know, Chris, he would have ended the suffering of Iraq, the suffering of Iraqi people. He would have ended the suffering of the military of the coalition. And now the coalition forces would have gone to their homes, to their countries, because peace and law and order would have been prevailed.
Could he have avoided the sectarian redefinition of Iraqi politics?
Well, he could if the U.S. didn't insist on having an early election. He could. And yes, I am with democracy. I am with the human rights, Chris. I am not against democracy. But we shouldn't have it too soon. Too soon, and people, the majority of the people were still injured of the Saddam regime. Mm. And they wanted to revenge. If your revenge leading you, you will not be a good ruler, actually. There are people, look, why do you ignore completely the Arab Sunni? I am secular and don't care about any sect, any religions. But you should balance. I mean, after the majority of Shia were prevented from taking lead for 8 years, and then suddenly you give them that. And they were suffering for 30 years from the regime, and then you give them the rule, what will happen? They will not see the benefit. I mean, the of the entire country. They will see only their need.
There's no way.
I am sorry to talk like this. I love my country and love all the people of my country, Shia or Sunni or Kurd or Yazidi, or but a truth should be a truth. One has to say the right thing to save this country from going in ruin more and more.
And what is the hardest thing to say?
Well, look what is happening. A district of a Christian Assyrian south of Baghdad, we call it Dora, Muslim extremists or a criminal, perhaps. The government doesn't agree, of course, or the America. They go and tell them to leave houses, or we kill you, or we butcher you. They leave houses and they steal the house and the property. And they come to either to leave the country or go to other part of Baghdad, which is a little savior. Not only Christian, even Muslim people, Sunni.
But these are Shiite Muslim militias that are doing this.
That's in the militia. The militia Shi'i doing it, and the Wahhabis, and the Sunni, the Qaeda, and the extremists, all these sharing, not only the Shia militia. There are other militia. And the criminals, the bandits, the criminal are seizing the opportunity to play on the, on this, you know, to play. Well, Chris, it is enough. I think you make me feel really very sad.
Mm.
I feel sad when I talk about my country. Because I know nothing of such thing should have happened.
Too late now. But
it is too late now. It is too late now. Well, I believe they can do it, but this is, Bush and his administration doesn't want to go back to a dictatorship regime. No. I advise a martial law, announcing a martial law, and abolishing the present parliament, and stopping any election for 2 years, and bringing Ayad Alawi as a prime minister. He will choose a strong minister, and he will rebuild the army and the police, and wait 2 years. Let the American army stay in barracks, not in towns, in bases outside the cities. Watch. If everything done well, they could leave. If not, let them interfere. Khalas.
We call that the Dr. Ben plan. My plan is to keep talking with you. It's been a great pleasure. Dr. Ben Abu al-Souf, thank you.
Thank you, Christopher Leiden. I am glad you make me talk. I don't want to stay like this immigrant with my home divided and under a severe, insecure situation.
To a peaceful Iraq. Inshallah.
Inshallah.